if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
Recently, Over Coffee had the opportunity to be part of a first-time ever event, Mystic Dragons Book Festival in the City of Industry. During the festival, we interviewed six of the exhibiting authors and artists. Here's our second interview from the festival.
Well, here's a question for you. Have you ever given a whole lot of thought to pigeons? I can't really say I ever have until the next author's book came along. Lucien F.A. Van Oosten is a mixed-media artist with numerous honors. He's exhibited in a lot of different venues, and he's the author of K-Bridge, a story of discovery, growth, and leadership told through the story of a flock of whimsical pigeons. Lucien, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how did you first find inspiration in nature as a young man growing up in the, I believe, San Gabriel Valley area?
That's a good question. I used to love to go hiking up in the San Gabriel Mountains, and I had various interests as a child, from pigeons to snakes to mice, and I had a very good upbringing in the sense that my family allowed me to have these as pets. And so for years I had multiple pets until I left home.
I'm thinking, oh, I'm glad you didn't write about snakes. How did pigeons first come into your radar?
I was in fifth grade. We had moved from Europe, and being new to this country, not speaking the language, I was kind of treated like an outsider, and I used to go to the playground, and along the back of the playground there was this ivy-covered fence, and of course on the other side were all these homes. And one day I was there, heard the cooing, and looked through the ivy, and there was a pigeon loft. And so it became my sanctuary, if you will, and I used to go there during recesses and just watch the birds. And then one day this woman came out and said, I've been watching you looking at the birds. Would you like to come over and see them? And I said, I'd have to ask my mom, which I did, who said I could go so long as I took my brothers. And we did go over there, and it was a very exciting and fun experience. And we got to go into the loft. We got to handle some of the birds. And eventually this woman offered to give me a pair. So being a kid, you know, you run home, tell your mom, hey, I got this wonderful opportunity. And she said, okay, build yourself a loft and you can have it, but you're fully responsible for everything. That's how it started.
That is great. What was life like as a pigeon owner?
It's kind of exciting, a little scary, because the first time you let them go, you don't know if they're going to come back. And as you grow and learn, and I did a lot of reading that first 3 years, I think I got every book out of the library that I could on pigeons, and slowly started to learn how to go about getting them to stay at the loft. And that was quite an experience and a lot of fun. Over time, the other kids in the neighborhood got pigeons, and we actually, at a very young age, were doing pigeon racing, you know. It wasn't very professional, but it was a lot of fun.
And now you belonged in the neighborhood and you had friends thanks to having pigeons.
Right. We had friends, and they got pigeons, and so, yeah, it was a lead-in to meeting other people, you know. And it kind of stayed with me until I was 35, because that's when my family started to grow, and I had to kind of give it up, because it's a very expensive hobby when you start flying racing homers.
Now, how do you train pigeons to come back? What do you do?
Well, part of it is, of course, it's an instinct that they have, and you try to find the birds that have the strongest instinct, so you start looking. There's a belief within the pigeon world that a pigeon's eye sign is an avenue, if you will, a window into their soul, and tells you whether or not they have good homing instincts.
A pigeon's eye sign, what does that mean?
That basically means when you're looking at the eye, you want a crisp, clean eye. Some people believe that when it's a beautiful orange eye with white around it and a sharp black pupil, that those are signs of a good, intelligent pigeon. And it can be, they have pearl eyes, they have orange eyes, they have red eyes. So there's a different things you look for, including body structure and form.
You just taught me a lot that I didn't know about pigeons in just the first few minutes. How did you first get into drawing what you saw in nature, your pigeons and other creatures, and how did you know that that was going to be your path in life?
Well, I really never knew it was my path in life. I've been drawing cartoony type animals ever since I can remember, which kind of slowly evolved into drawing more realistic animals. the person that really got me to slow down and see what was around me wasn't until I was actually in college and had an art teacher who would tell me I drew too fast. I had an art teacher in high school who told me I didn't know how to draw at all. And so this gentleman, I can't remember his name, actually slowed me way down, brought me into contact with an artist named Seurat's technique, which was drawing everything with little points of color. And so he taught me how to draw with little points, just black and white. And that's called stippling, and that's how I started really getting to understand form, structure, shape.
That must be very helpful when drawing the art for your new book, Cambridge.
Yeah, it helped me quite a bit. Cambridge, you know, it's like everything else. You start from a basic concept, and it just kind of evolves. And especially if you just let the creative side of your mind go and have the ability to shut down that critical, analytical side long enough, you generally can do great things.
Off the mic before, you were telling me the story of how Cambridge came about, and I just wish you'd share that story right now.
Okay, Cambridge came about actually as an assignment in my final year of college. I was taking a design class, graphic design class, and I was taking a class on a program about publication and how to publish. And the same professor taught both classes, and so she gave the assignment, you need to create a 20-page book, you need to do all the illustrations, you need to do the cover art, you need to write the book, you need to put it together, and finally, neat bind it as if it were a book coming off the shelf. And so the book started off with me wanting to write 20 pages about what a pigeon thinks about its birth and how it perceives it, and it just kept going and involved in by the end of the semester, it was a 168-page book, and there was other things in it that I wanted to write about, so I had to do two little drop-offs, or what I call Saturday night specials, where you know you want to see or know what's going on. So there are cliffhangers throughout the book, actually two. So that's how it kind of came about. The book wound up being 168 pages at the end of the semester, and I kept writing after that class and finished the second book in that writing and did the outline and part of the writing for the third book.
From there, how'd you make the journey into taking Cambridge into a published volume?
Well, when the book came out originally and the professor saw it, she was just amazed by it. Got me a friend of hers that actually was an editor, and she edited the book and then said, you got to go to publishing houses and get it published. I had a lot of rejection letters the first 2 years. This was back in 2003, and decided, you know, maybe it's just not time and maybe it's not ready. Over the years, I've looked at self-publishing and the price was pretty outrageous. And then last year, in September, I met another artist and we got to talking about the art, and I decided it was time to try to publish the book. My daughter helped me find a publisher called Creative Space, which happens to belong to Amazon as well, and just started and took off from there. Just decided to do it.
I really like that response to the rejection, not, oh, I can't do it, but maybe it's just not time. What else would you say to other artists or authors that are having to deal with rejection, if anybody's going to have to, if they've been an artist for longer than 5 minutes?
I think the biggest thing that you have to do is you have to believe in yourself and what you're trying to do. Always be true to yourself, no matter what. And then come to the realization that there's certain things that aren't meant to happen all the time when you want. And sometimes you just have to step back and reassess. And I think that's the most important part, the ability to reassess it. And then when an opportunity does come along that seems like it fits all the things you want to do, not be afraid to step through that door and just go do it.
What said to you, this fits all the things I want to do? What came along to say, now's the time?
I think it was the fact that I had several people look at the illustrations again from the book and get all excited about it. I had one person who wanted to buy the whole sketchbook with all the illustrations, which didn't happen, but it was a really flattering moment. And I thought, okay, maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to go out there and try this. And so I had some extra cash from having sold several pieces of art. And of course, that's always helpful. And decided to go ahead and just do it.
And it's certainly time right now for our listeners to get acquainted with Mosaic and its flock. Would you read from your book, please, Cambridge?
Yes, I will. And I decided to read a little bit of chapter 11, which is where you meet, or you actually get a chance to get to know Trapper a little bit. I'll set the scene for you. He's a loft pigeon. He was out just flying, as loft pigeons do, by their owners, released. And he got caught in a terrible windstorm. And this is kind of what happens near the end of that episode. Trapper realized that something wasn't right. he had already had his experience more than twice. The second time he had it was worse than the first. And here it was starting again for the third time. The first thing he remembered was that it was a beautiful day. The sun was shining and there were very small, puffy white clouds in a soft blue sky. It was calm, really peaceful and beautiful. And everything was right with the world, his world. Yes, he thought contently, all is right with my world. Trapper loved to fly, to feel the wind in his face, to be in command of his wings, and to charge off where he was going and choosing his own speed. Some pigeons fly because they have to. Some like flying, and yet others really like their ability to fly. He was one of those that cherished it, with the emphasis on the word cherished. So here he was, doing his most favorite thing in the world, flying in a good stout breeze, when all of a sudden the breeze turned into a wind. But not just any wind. The harder he flew, the harder the wind blew, and the more severe it became, until it was a monster of a wind. The sky had turned from blue to black. The wind, his friend, had suddenly turned into the wind, his enemy. Instead of a gentle, purring cat, it had become a raging, roaring lion. Instead of moving forward, he was hanging in midair. The wind was holding him stationary, like a kite. No matter how hard he beat his wings, up, down, it made no difference. The wind kept him in one spot. It was a strange and unusual feeling to be hovering like that, and because he had never done it before, it was kind of fun and scary, in a sort of way. Nevertheless, he wanted to stop. It was more scary than fun because he had no control over what was happening, or more accurately, he had no control over his own actions. This, for a bird on the wing, was not a good thing. So here he was. The second he had made a little headway, it happened again. The sky went from blue to black. The wind became more severe in its speed and turned into a monster cat, using its gusts like a cat uses its paws, pushing him this way and that. First, a gust would push him left, and as soon as he felt he had control, another burst would push him right, and another would push him down, and then up. While he was being blown about every now and again, the sky would partially clear and he'd see the snow-covered mountain, a giant bowl, a giant cross, a vertical glass cliffs, all in flashes like a strobe light going off, illuminating a frozen frame in time. Eventually, he was so tired, he fell downward to the ground, or rather, he felt he was being pushed to the ground, where he landed in some kind of soft material. Then the whole sequence of events would start again, like an old movie flickering by on a screen of his mind. Sometimes slowly and other times so fast it was a blur. He was both the audience and the star of the scenes that were being displayed for his viewing. Am I dreaming? He wondered. All he knew by the end was that he was exhausted, too tired to move. He was sore in every feather, every joint and muscle of his body. Whether he was dreaming or not, he wanted all of this to stop. He wanted to open his eyes and find himself in his own loft, or any place where the wind could not get to him. Someplace, any place, just not here. Please, he begged silently, no more. Let me be in a safe place. Let me be home.
Wow. You and I are listening to Lucien F.A. Van Oosten, who is the author of the new book, Cambridge. And Lucien, what I really like about Cambridge is the way that you get into the heads of the birds, and you never become precious with it. And I feel like I am Trapper caught in a nightmare. What's the technique of doing that?
I think the technique is actually trying to look at it from that bird's perspective, like getting your head into that particular scene with that particular character. And I think the entire book revolves around the premise that a person's perception is their reality. And so when I start with that as the starting point, then I have to figure out what reality that bird's in, whether he be good or bad, whether he be smart or not. You have to try to figure out how he perceives the world and what he's trying to do.
Let's look at some of the realities of the different birds that you introduced. Your main character, Mosaic, is an interesting one.
Yeah, Mosaic's young, innocent, not very confident in a lot of ways, but he doesn't allow that to show. I think the bottom line is he believes in himself. And because of that, of course, he has certain prejudices that come out that he has to deal with as the story evolves.
He's on a journey of discovery. what does he learn about leadership and what does he learn about himself without being a total spoiler here?
I don't think it's a total spoiler to say that he actually realizes that what we just mentioned earlier, that a bird or a person's perspective is their reality. And the only way that can change is by being introduced to new things or looking at things in a slightly different way, accepting, in this case, Trapper's friendship and Trapper's belief that humans aren't bad, while Mosaic's belief is that they are, because of what's happened to the flock.
And we won't, again, make it a spoiler, but it's a story well worth traveling. It's going to take you some places that you didn't expect, is what I discovered as your reader. Tell me about Krafko, too. I don't quite figure out what makes him tick.
Well, Krafko's an interesting character, and I won't reveal a lot about him right now, but in the second book, you understand why he became the way he became. And that's not to justify it. It's just to say this is the reality of it. And it goes into, again, perspective, what you believe, and how things can change. And that, I think, even when you read the book, you look at it, every bird or every person makes a decision that starts to dictate their life. And I think with when you meet how Krafko evolved to where he is, it's an interesting perspective on him. And again, it's trying to get into the head of different birds.
I like how the friendship between Mosaic and Trapper is kind of complementary to both of them, how they kind of both grow in it.
Yeah, I think it was important to me to put it in terms where, you know, there's one part in the book where neither one of them are really wanting to call the other one a liar and really push on them because they really want to be friends. And I think that's the way life really is, that people want to be honest with each other and sometimes you hold back a little bit. Mosaic, of course, is of the opinion that humans are bad. Trapper is a loft pigeon, so he's always been raised by humans. He understands humans in a different way. And it's like Trapper knows things that Mosaic doesn't know and tries to explain them to Mosaic. And Mosaic, you know, doesn't really believe him, but at the same time doesn't want to call him a liar. And Trapper doesn't want to call Mosaic stupid. So they kind of refrain a little bit from that, even though they touch on it, so that they can actually have their friendship come to fruition because they both like each other, you know, for who and what they are, what they see, that first impression that you get.
These are some great little scenes. I'm intrigued because you have the pigeons in almost a society, a culture, where they have customs. The flock will never, for example, approach another flock without permission to land. Where's all this coming from?
Well, I think what's going on in the world is I think we lack, we don't respect other people's space and other people's cultures and reality. And I think you have to accept that. And I think it's always good to be invited in. I think it comes from living in Europe and, you know, you're always invited into the home, but you just don't walk in. And it's like, to me, I think that's where a lot of people mess up. It's the same thing like, you know, friendships start by being invited into that personal space. Everybody has their own personal space that they feel comfortable in. And I think that includes not only space, but includes conversations and what topics you can touch on and everything else. And I think the real communication is getting permission to touch on those. And those happen a lot of different ways. I think in today's society, with the internet and everything else, I think people are losing the ability to read each other so that they know that it's okay to do that. And I think that's one of the things I think we're losing as a people. And it's not that the internet isn't a great thing, and it allows you quick communication. But I think you can write things on the internet that if you say them, they're accepted differently than reading them. And I think that's, and a lot of people have lost the ability to really write, you know, to express themselves in a way that says, this is what I'm at, this is what I'm am, this is who I'm about. And it's not that I think you're any less or more, this is just who I am. You know, and that understanding, that belief that everybody has a right to exist. And I do believe that's like a universal truth, but there's other universal truths as well, you know, and as cultures, we seem to ignore those. We don't seem to accept those about each other. And I think this book tries to cross those paths. It does it subtly. It doesn't do it with a big, I'm going to hit you over the head with a sledgehammer approach. But I think a lot of it is in there for people to hopefully pull out of it and see that a lot of things that people make offensive isn't really offensive.
So that would be something definitely to keep in mind as we read Cambridge and its sequels. Now, what will we see happening for Pepper in the second book?
Well, Pepper in the second book doesn't come up very much because she really hits the third book, The Quest. But Pepper is, of course, a healer and looks at life a little differently than some of the other birds do. And I won't go into too much detail about it, but Pepper really helps Doofus in the third book, and you become, I think Doofus in the first book is presented as pretty much a dummy, and I think in the third book you realize what's been going on that creates that dummy. Dummy, not that he is a dummy, but that belief that he is, you know, lacking. And so it has to do with things you're exposed to. That's the best way I can describe it without giving it all away.
Once again, the idea of perception being a reality perception. And not necessarily a reality.
Right. Perception is part of it. You know, I mean, my daughter teaches underprivileged kids, you know, and you get to feel that there's more there a lot of times than what the surface shows. You know what I mean? And I think every person, no matter what, I guess what conflicts they have with themselves, with the world, how they're handicapped, wants to know that they're cared about. And I think that's important. And I think that helps a lot of people get better at what they do. You know, it's one of the things in teaching art. It's not that like I try to explain to the people that I'm teaching, it's not that what you're doing is bad. It's I have a certain lesson plan in mind, but I never want you to lose what you want to try to do. So all I'm giving you is the tools, and hopefully so that you can express yourself better. And I think that's the most important thing. And I think that's what a lot of people lose, you know, in trying to teach. It's not always you're the right one. It's bringing out what's right for that person.
And right can be very different with this person versus that one versus that one.
Correct. Correct. It can be different for different people, and it can all still fit into the same world, you know. I think that's what's partly wrong with it, with the world myself, that not enough people are willing to really look at each other and accept each other for who what they are.
And we see that in many ways with K-Bridge and with Mosaic. Now, where exactly is K-Bridge located?
Well, actually, K-Bridge is a bridge that crosses Route 66 in the city I live in, Glendora. And one day I was driving down the Route 66, and this pigeon flew in and under and into the rafters, and I thought, wow. And I was working on the book. I thought, that's a great place for a pigeon to live. That's wild, right? Because it affords them a certain amount of protection, helps them stay away from predators. So it became... K-Bridge became, the bridge isn't called K-Bridge, it just came out as K-Bridge. I don't know where the K came from, it just popped into my head and stuck. And then the rail yard part of it happened when I was driving the old Pasadena Freeway crossing this bridge as you go up towards Dodger Stadium and you look down and there's the rail yard. And again, driving along, seeing these pigeons fly through there, I thought, God, why can't I put them together and make it work? So that's how that whole thing came about.
Why is there a kind of dark, spooky section to the rail yard?
Because I think that within any community, in any world, there are things that are dark and scary. And part of it is that humans tend to do that to each other and for each other. And they create dark and scary places. They create the dump yards where everything goes. And, you know, all the things in the dump yard are what? Are rejected things from society, from individual people. So I think that... in order to make it work as a world, a pigeon's world, that also had to be included. I couldn't just ignore that side of it. And in order to have that, in order to have craft go, I had to have that as well.
So. Well, I love how you immerse me in the world of the pigeons, because I'll read it and I won't remember I'm reading about pigeons until somebody like Pepper says, well, I can't put my wingtip on it, but I can't trust him, or something like that. What do you tell your students about creating nature and staying true to what they see?
I think the biggest thing I tell my students is to actually look and see the form of the structure, see the topographical features of anything, whether it be a sea creature, a lion, tiger, a tree. And that's how I teach. I teach by starting with the basics, which is usually outline drawing. And then I do a lot of work with them a lot on topographical drawings so that they can actually see the structure and the surface. And the big thing is seeing what's there as you see it, and then teaching them the techniques of how to draw things so that it looks more natural. That I have a lot of time I spent with them on doing grayscale study, where you go from the lightest, you can use a pencil, to the darkest. I basically teach drawing without using an eraser. So they're not allowed to use an eraser, so it teaches them to really look in multiple lines. When a person, and an artist, at least in my case, when I look at stuff, my eye, the creative eye, is trying to pick up all the form and structure. So there'll be multiple lines that'll try to describe what's there. And then as an artist, you try to figure out which one of those lines you're going to use. And even the lines you don't use become part of the drawing because they are part of the structure. So that's how I teach. Yeah, that's how I teach.
Our listeners might like to know where you teach.
Right now I'm teaching for the San Dimas Parks and Recreation. I have a class that's drawing without an eraser, as I just explained. And then I have another class that's painting with the primary colors only. So in that class, it's you work with red, blue, and yellow, and white as an accent color, and you create entire paintings using just those three colors.
Wow, San Dimas Parks and Rec, you hopefully will get some people contacting you through this, because that sounds like a fantastic class.
Yeah, it is. A lot of people that have taken it have told me that. They like my teaching style. Like I said earlier, it's about getting people to come out and feel comfortable within themselves to express themselves. You know, it's not always about what I think is right, but it's still teaching them the techniques that I know are right and then allowing them the opportunity to use them to their creative level. And then building on that. That's what it's all about. It's a building block process in my mind.
As an artist yourself who's building and constantly learning and growing, how have you most been inspired the past, let's say, 6 months or so by nature, and what have you learned?
The biggest thing that's inspired me is actually teaching students and looking at it from a different perspective. And it's, again, kind of funny when I say it that way, but, you know, not everybody sees things the exact same way. Not everybody sees the color red exactly the same way. And so the most interesting part of teaching is pulling back a little bit and saying, okay, from this person's perspective, does this make sense? From this person's perspective, can it evolve into something that they like? Not so much that I like, that they like. Because I really believe that as an artist, when you express yourself, you have to be able to like what you do. Okay? And once you get to the point where you like what you do, it comes easier the next time and the next time. It's the analytical side that criticizes, that actually, to me, is what stops an artist from being an artist, stops a writer from being a writer. I don't believe in, there's no way to not be creative, and there's no such thing as writer's block. But like I tell them, if you have writer's block, just write, I have writer's block, until it stops.
Oh, I love that for an exercise.
Well,
that's great.
Think about it. If you say I have writer's block and you put the pencil down and walk away and don't write, what have you just given your analytical side?
You've just let it win.
Right.
Wow.
Now, if you take your creative side, which now you've totally let it shut down, if you say, okay, creative side, just write down, analytical side, we're just going to write. I can't write. I have writer's block. And surprisingly enough, when I've given that exercise to people in art and drawing, they start to feel comfortable with the process. And once you start feeling comfortable with the process, then it's easier to do it again. You know, and I don't believe that there's such a thing as I'm not in the mood to draw, because I think you teach yourself to be in the mood all the time. And again, what's going on in your head is the analytical side is trying to shut down the creative side.
Now, I write, but I don't paint. So if I came to you as your student and I said, I don't paint, how would we get around the analytical side of my brain so that I could paint?
Basically, it's starting off with just, here are the three primary colors, and you have to believe me that when you mix blue and red, you're going to get a purple color, and then if you add yellow to it, you're going to get different browns until you eventually get to almost a pure black. And I have a lot of students who go, oh, that doesn't make sense, you know, and I'm going, try it. And they are reluctant because they want to pull out that tube of paint that's the right color and squeeze it out and think they're going to be okay. But once they start seeing that there is a lot more richness and variety and uniformity when they mix their own colors, that isn't there if you just use straight tube. Because, you know, it's the understanding that if the light hits something, there's multiple tonal qualities that occur. You know, there's the highlight, there's the secondary light, there's the reflective light. All these things come into play, and when you learn to mix the colors yourself from the three primaries, those things start to make sense because they come across correctly.
I would think that would be a very satisfying experience too, is getting to make purple a different maybe value than you would from that tube, getting to make a very rich brown that maybe would be more the color of the pigeon's feathers, for example, if you were painting a pigeon.
I think that's the most important thing. I think a lot of people rely on the pigmented colors, think that if they just throw that down, they'll have the right brown. You know what I mean? and it just doesn't work that way.
It goes right back to what you were saying about computers, the internet, and kind of losing our creativity.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think people just need to get comfortable within themselves. That's what it's all about. That's what really creativity is to me, is being comfortable with what you yourself have that you want to express and put out there for other people to look at. The reality of life is not everything you do, everybody's going to love. And if you can accept that aspect of putting yourself out there, no matter what it is, whether it be you want to be a cook, you want to be a chef, you want to be a painter, you want to be an author, you want to write, whatever medium you want to express yourself in, not everybody's going to like what you do. And if you can accept that, then I think you can succeed.
As we conclude here, what would you most like people to know from you and from K-Bridge about innovation, creativity, and making a difference?
I think the most important thing that the book presents is there are a lot of different ways to look at the world. I think there's a lot of different ways to look at each other. I think there's a lot of acceptance that's going on. Even though they get angry with each other, they're not happy with each other, there's still a certain amount of acceptance that occurs. And that there is a universal evil, and that those are the things that you do have to deal with. And I think the overall message of the book is, you know, I think it's the end, be kind to one another. Be accepting of one another, and believe there are things out there that you may not know everything about.
And before we go, I completely forgot to ask you to share a resource of which I was completely unaware before I read your book, the American Pigeon Museum. I never heard of that before I read K-Bridge.
Well, the American Pigeon Museum is something that's been around for a while, but there are a lot of pigeon fanciers in the world and in the United States. I went to the Grand National Pigeon Show this last January in Ontario, California, and they had 8,000 different types of pigeons. Well, 8,000 pigeons on display, numerous different breeds, and it was amazing to see all these different birds, their coloration, their body structure. It was just, as a pigeon person, it was kind of like, whoa, this has changed a lot from when I was a kid. You know, so it was fun.
I did not know there were 8,000 different breeds of pigeons.
Well, I'm not sure there's 8,000, but there's plenty of different breeds. And they were showing 8,000 birds was the actual number of birds there. And I don't know how many different breeds there were, but they've got birds that are called frill wings, which actually have their feathers are actually curled on their wings rather than smooth like you would expect a pigeon to be. There's birds that have muffs on their feet where the feathers on their feet are 3 inches long, 4 inches long, you know. They have tumblers that actually fly, and as they fly, they break, and then they start tumbling backwards in the sky, like, and just, you know, and there's rollers that do it a little differently. So there's all kinds of birds out there that are bred for all kinds of different events and activities, if you want to call them that.
I'd love to see the tumblers.
Oh, they're crazy. It's crazy to watch.
Are you going to have pigeons again in the future, or is that something about which you will write and draw instead?
I think I'll probably stick with the writing and the drawing of it. It's a little cleaner way to keep the hobby, but because one of the things you learn as you grow up, that one of the things that's not fun is the cleanup part of it. But it's a great hobby, and if you love birds, and you know, but cities have also changed now. Well, the ordinance have changed, and you know, where before you could keep a chicken coop and keep a certain number of chickens, you could keep pigeons and keep a certain number of pigeons. A lot of them now have ordinances that basically say it's got to be so many feet from every property line, and if your neighbors complain, you can't have them anymore. So it's moved more, and that surprises me, it's moved, at least in a lot of cities in California, more to the rural areas or the outskirts, while in New York, they actually fly off the rooftops. In Europe, a lot of them do the same thing. And some of these lofts are better than some people's homes that I've seen. It's crazy.
Wow. Your eyes lit up when you were talking about the pigeons. You are a total enthusiast here. Where can people see your work? Where can they get your book? And what is any website you would like to recommend?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I'm on a website called Fan Art Review, where my work's on display. If you put my name into the computer search engine, I show up. I do several shows throughout the state. It just depends what's going on, and I don't have a regular gallery I'm at right now. I was for a while, but I'm not there now. And my time is spent right now working on the next couple of books to get them set up to be released. So that's where I'm spending my time. These kind of events are fun. You meet people, get a chance to talk to people.
Can't wait to see the sequels to K-Bridge. And what's the title of that again?
The sequel is going to be The Rescue, and then the third book is The Quest. So The Rescue is coming out, if everything stays according to my plans, sometime the middle of November, and then The Quest will probably be a year away.
Lucien, thank you for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You and I have been listening to artist Lucien F.A. Van Oosten, the author of K-Bridge. Look for November to have his second installment of the story of Mosaic and His Flock coming out. You're with Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon, back at 1 o'clock this afternoon with additional interviews.
And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomaverix.com. That's twomaverix.com. And you can contact us at twomaverix@gmail.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.